host, David Day. You can learn more about ThinkTech and listen to earlier ThinkTech radio and video shows at thinktechhawaii.com. And tune in again tomorrow at 4 o'clock for Find Out Friday on the ThinkTech radio series right here on AM 760 KGU.
Hawaii's Business Authority, KGU, Honolulu.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
Covering the financial and business news you need to know.
With SRN News, I'm Gordon Griffin. FBI Special Agent in Charge Jim McCone says it's confirmed that a body found this week in Colorado is that of the missing 10-year-old girl, Jessica Ridgway.
On behalf of the FBI and the Department of Justice, I want to extend my sincere condolences to the Ridgway family.
Ridgway began a short walk from her home to Witt Elementary School the morning of October the 5th, but never arrived. A massive search by hundreds of law enforcement officers did not start until hours later because Jessica's mother works nights and slept through a call from school officials saying Jessica wasn't there. Pakistani officials say suspects have been arrested in the case of a 14-year-old girl, Malala Yousafzai, shot and wounded by the Taliban for advocating education for girls in the mostly Muslim country. Pakistani Senator Rubina Khalid says the nation's outraged by the shooting.
Malala can be anybody's child. It is not that this thing will stop at one person. This thing will carry on unless and until we all decide to stand up to it and say, no, we have had enough.
A Taliban spokesman said that the girl had been warned three times to stop advocating for Western values. She's been airlifted to a Pakistan military hospital for treatment of her wounds. Also at SRNNews.com, Denver police say that it appears one shot has been fired at the Denver office of President Obama's reelection campaign. A police spokeswoman told the Denver Post no one was injured in the shooting. A large panel of glass was left shattered. The latest attempt by airlines to raise fares has collapsed.
United Airlines says it's rolled back an increase of $4 to $10 per round trip on many U.S. routes. Delta Airlines, which had matched the price hike that United began earlier this week, subsequently dropped prices back. J.P. Morgan analyst Jamie Baker says the increase unraveled because it gained only limited support from a few other carriers.
That's SRN's correspondent Jeremy House reporting, and this is SRN News.
The Business Software Alliance wants you to know that if you work for a company that copies software illegally, you're working for a company...
Hey, speak up. I can't hear you. Everyone knows that copying software illegally is breaking the law and creates unfair advantage. No need to whisper. If you see this happening where you work, report it confidentially to the BSA. Just visit nopiracy.org. In addition to doing what's right, report software piracy, and you may also be eligible for a cash reward. That's nopiracy.org.
For the first time in our history, America's credit rating has been downgraded, and AMAC has an answer to that news. Never again. AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens, is the conservative alternative to the AARP. AMAC cares about the issues conservatives care about. If you're 50 or older, help us get to 1 million members by the 2012 elections. Join AMAC now. Go to tearupyourcar.com or call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to tearupyourcar.com.
Remember when you were 17, in great shape and feeling good? Not a care in the world. Well, here it is today, and there's a growing family to take care of. Of course, you've done some growing, too. But many of us do gain weight as we get older. 20, 30 pounds, 40, but 100 pounds? Deep down inside, you know how serious it is. So it's the right time to get back into shape and be there for your family. The Surgical Weight Loss Institute at Castle Medical Center is staffed by caring experts and the only center of excellence for bariatric surgery in Hawaii. Not only will they share their proven surgical weight loss plan, they'll help you through diet, exercise, and education. At Castle Medical Center, the doctors and nurses are more than just experts. They're lifestyle coaches who understand how much you want to be there for your son's graduation, your daughter's wedding, every baby luau that follows. Sound good? Good. Take the first step and visit castlemed.org or call 263-5176. Castle Medical Center, exceptional medicine by exceptional people.
Talk about experience. For nearly 30 years, DHX, Dependable Hawaiian Express, has successfully handled transportation services to and from Hawaii. Our employees know all the ropes. We're dedicated people working with a sense of urgency and care. We operate our own trucks in Honolulu, Maui, the Big Island, American Samoa, and Guam, so you can be confident of on-time, safe, and seamless ocean and air freight service. Next time, call the experienced people at DHX, Dependable Hawaiian Express, and relax. We're dependable from start to finish.
Can't find a jeweler to repair your broken jewelry or replace missing stones, restring your pearls? Hi, this is Brenda Rutschel of Carrots and Carrots Fine Jewelry. We make miracles happen with your broken or damaged jewelry. We're a full-service jeweler. We repair gold, silver, and platinum jewelry. We even polish diamonds and gemstones. Bring us your jewelry to repair at our new location in the Ainahaina Shopping Center. Carrots and Carrots, 735-2301.
Aloha, Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy here. A breath of fresh air is what you need on your afternoon drive home, not the boring windbags. Can I say that? Tune in Monday through Friday. That's Hawaii's Tomorrow, 5 to 6 p.m., 760 KGU. Aloha.
Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy, presents Hawaii's Tomorrow, a series of discussions about Hawaii's business future, led by experts in their respective fields. Today's contributing host is the man himself, Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Happy Aloha Friday, everyone. I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy, on this finally VOG-free Friday, October 12th. Bird is the word on today's show, as we are going to be talking to the utmost authorities on Hawaii's birds. That's right, we have with us Sheila Conant here to talk to us about endangered forest birds, and David Heirenbach to share his super interesting research involving marine plastics in seabirds, especially those albatrosses. So feel free to join us today and call into the show 808-296-5467. Whether you're a birder or not, today is going to start your weekend off right. Our show today has been made possible by Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and Hawaii's new COSI program, Island Earth. COSI is an NSF-funded program with 14 centers across the United States. First up today is Dr. Sheila Conant. Born and raised in Hawaii, Sheila began studying Hawaiian birds more than 45 years ago. Sheila's primary interests are ecology and conservation of native Hawaiian birds, plants, and invertebrates. Congratulations on your recent retirement from University of Manoa. 40 years of service. That's amazing. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. And now I'm busier than ever.
Well, that's usually the way it is, isn't it? So let's talk Hawaiian forest birds. First off, what is a Hawaiian forest bird and what makes them so special?
When I think of Hawaiian forest birds, I'm thinking of native Hawaiian forest birds, which means that these are the birds that were not introduced by people, but those birds that got here on their own a long time ago and evolved into quite a number of different species. And that's part of what makes them so special, because there are so many unique species. There was a time when we had over 100 species of native land birds in Hawaii, and every single one of those was found only in Hawaii, and that makes them really special to me and to everybody that lives in Hawaii.
So do we still have those kind of numbers of Hawaiian forest birds, or where are we at with that?
Unfortunately not. We've lost well over half of the birds that we would think of as Hawaiian forest birds for many, many different reasons, in part because we've lost a great deal of our Hawaiian forests. Lowland forests are almost non-existent these days. And even the medium wet and rainforest areas are very much decreased in area. And along with that, there have been a lot of bird extinctions because they've lost their habitat. And there are some other reasons, too, that we could talk about if you'd like.
So are there places that the average citizen can go still and see Hawaiian native forest birds?
Well, there are. It's a little bit of work, usually. Here on Oahu, one could see the endangered Oahu elepaio on a hike to Pia Valley, or perhaps on a hike to someplace in the northern Waianae Mountains. There is also a chance that you could see an Oahu amakihi in the back of Manoa Valley, for example, where I live. I have them in my garden during the breeding season, and I can hear them singing. But that's pretty unusual. on Maui or Kauai or the Big Island, it's a lot easier to see birds. But to see the really rare ones takes a little bit of work.
And so you've been doing this for a really long time. What particularly about these native forest birds interests you?
Well, when I was a student in college, I knew that I liked vertebrates, animals with backbones, mammals, birds, and fish. And I'm more of a forest person than an ocean person, so I knew it would have to be birds. And I was really glad to have made that choice. And right away, I was interested in ecology and behavior. And once you start paying attention to Hawaiian forest birds, you can't ignore the fact that so many of them have become extinct, and that the ones we have left, many of them are in danger of going extinct. We have some extremely rare birds that we're really keeping a close eye on.
And so how do you measure the populations? How do you know when one goes extinct and one's doing better than the other?
Well, you never really know when something's extinct, because you can't really be sure that something isn't there. You know, you can only be sure that it is there. But in my lifetime of studying Hawaiian birds, I've seen individuals of 7 different species of birds, 6 of which are now believed to be extinct, and one of which is only still in existence in captivity. But there are ways of monitoring the rare birds, and there are a number of different approaches. Basically, we go out and count them, but we use some pretty specific methods. We usually go to the same places periodically, and the frequency with which we do that depends on how much money there is to pay people to get out and count birds. And we walk down a transect or a straight line and stop every so often, count birds for a set number of minutes, record which birds they are, whether we heard them or saw them, how far away they were. And then we take all that data and we hand it to some statistical wizards, and they come up with population estimates. But it's really difficult to get a population estimate that you can have a lot of confidence in. It's hard to know, unless you have a lot of good data, whether or not populations are actually increasing or decreasing. But we do have a few species for which we do have good enough data to tell that.
So you must have spent quite a bit of time in the forest over the years.
Yes, I have. And I did a lot of bird counting early on, and I've given that up. I just got tired of counting birds, and I'd rather watch them figuring out what they're eating, where they're nesting, how many eggs they lay, that sort of thing.
So do
but
you have
favorites? Birds need to be counted.
That's true. Do you have any favorites in particular?
Well, I started studying the Oahu elepaio for my master's degree in the mid-1960s, and there were quite a few of those birds around, and now it's listed as an endangered species. I studied it in the back of Manoa Valley, where I live, and it's not there anymore. You have to work really hard to get out and see it.
So what does that bird sound like, in case our listeners want to ever hear that bird or listen for it?
All right, well, I'll give it my best here.
Okay.
Well, that's a call note. I can't do a song, but it does sound like elepaio, something like that.
That was very impressive. Excellent. I'm very impressed.
I can't wait to hear what David is going to do.
That's true. So now we're concerned about these forest birds. How does climate change play into all of this?
Well, climate change has already begun to make a difference. One of the things that is an important limiting factor for the remaining native Hawaiian forest birds is the impact of avian disease. In particular, we know a lot about avian malaria. And avian malaria is transferred from one bird to another via a mosquito. And it happens to be that mosquito that bites you at night, the same one that transmits heartworm in dogs. So it's a mosquito that's good at what we say is vectoring disease. One of the reasons some of the birds are still doing okay is that this particular mosquito can only breed up to an altitude of about 4,000 or 4,500 feet. And as the climate changes, as things get a little bit warmer, one of the researchers at University of Hawaii has already demonstrated that the disease frequency seems to be increasing as we go uphill, and we think that the mosquitoes are going to be able to move uphill as well. And the unfortunate thing about that is that tree line is not a whole lot higher than 4,500 feet. In some places, it's as high as 9,000 feet. But the birds are going to be pressed into a smaller and smaller area in which they can survive because they won't be getting the disease because the mosquitoes aren't there. So climate change is going to have an impact. It already has. There are some birds on the island of Kauai that were recently listed in an emergency procedure by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because they were declining so rapidly. And we think that they're succumbing to avian malaria.
Wow. Well, I don't want to break for traffic on such a depressing note. I mean, this is very important stuff. But can you tell us one positive note or one success story real quickly before we go and break?
Well, sure. There is a bird that I think of as a forest bird, although it doesn't live in the forest, and that is the Nihoa Miller bird, which lives in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And we'll hear more about those later in the program. This little bird existed until very recently only on the island of Nihoa, which is just about 150 acres. Population was in the low hundreds. And I actually started studying the bird in 1980 and was hoping right from the beginning that we could find a way to start another population of Nihoa Miller birds. And a year ago September, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service caught and transported 24 birds to Laysan Island, which is 650 miles northwest of Nihoa. And in August, a second translocation was done, this time of 26 birds, and I got to go on that one. It was a thrill. The birds are doing just great. They're breeding, they're setting up territories, they're finding mates. And last year's group produced 17 young birds last spring. So that's a great note to end on.
I love those numbers. Sheila, you're amazing. Thank you so much. We'll be right back with David Heirenbach after this quick traffic break.
760 KGU.
Part of the Wall Street Business Network.
New accidents on the H1 freeway EVA bound at the Halawa Merge, on the H3 freeway Honolulu bound at the Hirono Tunnel, and in Kalihi we've got one on North King Street at Hufftailing. No problems to the windward side, and conditions are okay going out east to Hawaii Kai. The drive west has the H1 slowing at the Hickam Curve, the Moana Lua slows at Fort Shafter Flats, and if you're coming in from the west, expect a slowdown approaching the Middle Street Merge.
280,000 acres. That's the size of Molokai, Lanai, and Kahoolawe put together. It's also the amount of the prime farmable ag land designated in Hawaii. 280,000 acres. That's a lot of prime farmable ag land, and it needs to be preserved for agriculture. Aloha, I'm Dean Okimoto of Nalo Farms, and this fact is brought to you by Ho'opili, a new community where commercial farms, neighborhood, and home gardens will be part of the community's design. And there's so much more. Log on to www.ho'opili'oahu.com.
Over the past century, more than 90% of koa forests in Hawaii have disappeared as tropical hardwood prices have skyrocketed. Hawaii's koa forests are an important part of our ecosystem and a symbol of our island heritage. Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Hawaii's Tomorrow need your help to repopulate 1,000 acres on the Big Island with new koa trees. For $60, you can sponsor your very own koa legacy tree on the slopes of Mauna Kea. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Along with a beautifully engraved personalized certificate, $20 will also be donated to the charity or organization of your choice. Gift a gift that grows grander year after year. And see how simple the act of planting a tree can change the face of the planet. To plant your Hawaiian Koa Legacy Tree, go to hawaiistomorrow.com and click on the Legacy Tree icon. Again, hawaiistomorrow.com. That's Hawaii's with an S, tomorrow.com.
Aloha, it's Jeff. Is it hotter in your home than out on your lanai? Do you wish there was an energy-efficient way to cool down? Wouldn't it be nice to turn on the trays at the flip of a switch? Well, my friends at Island Cooling have been quietly promoting the energy-efficient whole house fan for years. It works by drawing fresh air through your home, pushing the hot air out through your attic. Call the whole house fan experts at Island Cooling, 672-2300, 672-2300, or go to islandcooling.com. Aloha.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, filling in for Jeff Davis. Now with us is Dr. David Heirenbach. David is an assistant professor in the College of Natural and Computational Sciences at Hawaii Pacific University and specializes in seabird ecology and conservation. David, welcome to the show. So tell me a little bit more. How do you use birds to monitor the ocean?
Yeah, there's basically two ways. I think traditionally people have studied the timing of the breeding, how well chicks are growing, how many are surviving. And this has given scientists a sense of how productive the ocean is, how much food is available for seabirds. That's the long look at seabirds as monitoring agents. But lately, we also use seabirds to understand about pollution in the ocean, just like things, for instance, like mussel watch, where the mussels filter the water and aggregate the pollutants in their tissues. We can use seabirds to concentrate some of this plastic debris, for instance, and therefore we learn about the ocean pollution via the eyes and the stomachs of the seabirds.
And so, talking about the forest birds with Sheila, how are our seabird populations doing? Are they experiencing the same fate, or?
Well, you know, it was really interesting listening to Sheila because she said she started studying their ecology and then she was drawn to the conservation. For me, it was the same. The realization that petrels in particular, albatrosses, shearwaters, fulmars, all these tube-nosed seabirds were highly endangered and the numbers of populations reaching critical conservation status was increasing all the time on a global scale. This was really what drove me into the conservation. So I think we find similar patterns, you know, across a lot of the different habitats where birds live.
And so how do you extract or understand mm-hmm. the plastics when you are studying the seabird? What techniques do you use?
Well, we have two basic ways. Sometimes the seabirds will aggregate this material just like an owl would aggregate the little pellets of fur and bones of mice. The birds aggregate this little pellets of squid beaks and plastic debris, and they puke them out. So this is very easy for us. We collect the material on the beaches, on the colonies, and we can recreate the plastic and part of the diet of the birds throughout their breeding season. That's the easier part. The harder part entails collecting dead seabirds that are opportunistically washing up on beaches or incidentally killed in fishing operations. We open them up, and then we obtain samples from their stomachs. And we can, again, recreate the plastic and other diet items that they have consumed.
So this bird puke mm-hmm. is basically like gold for both research and education purposes.
It is. It is definitely an amazing source of information. And, you know, every time you open a bolus, you find something new, something amazing, from a little toy soldier to a little piece of writing in a Japanese noodle cup or, you know, incredible things in the tummies of these birds. Yep.
That's amazing. What's the craziest or weirdest thing you've ever found?
I definitely think little toy soldiers. Definitely. Just because, you know, I used to play with little toy soldiers being a little boy, and I love them. So I've been able to meet again with a little German anti-tank guy with the bazooka and, you know, weird things like that. And I have discovered new types of soldiers that I was not aware of.
So you're building your collection one bolus at a time.
Definitely, definitely.
So obviously this is not a great indicator for the health of our oceans and the overuse of plastics. How bad is this problem, and is it particularly worse in Hawaii than elsewhere?
You know, I really think this is a global issue of pervasive reach. Places like Inaccessible Island, inaccessible, unreachable island is full of plastic on the beaches, and the birds that live there have plastic on their bellies. New Zealand birds, we think of New Zealand as a pristine place. Their albatrosses are full of plastic. So I think the conspiracy between the ocean currents and the vast migrations of the birds really lead to this, again, global footprint of this plastic sphere that is reaching every corner, even Antarctica, even the Arctic. Everywhere there is plastic at sea and in stomachs of seabirds.
And we're positioned in a pretty fortunate place to be able to study these. Mm-hmm. We have a really large seabird rookery, or place where the seabirds come. But they travel quite far, don't they? Are you coordinating with any researchers elsewhere in the world that are studying the same populations?
Yeah. In fact, the seabirds are ocean-wide, right? I have colleagues in Alaska that are studying New Zealand and Tasmanian shearwaters that are coming up and being killed in fisheries up in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. Our albatrosses here from the Northwest Islands are venturing all the way to Tokyo Bay, the Aleutians, and California. So again, a basin-wide perspective is really needed. So collaborations with people throughout the West Coast, Japan, the Southern Hemisphere, and Hawaii, and the Northwest Hawaiian Islands in particular, are really essential to understand the ocean-wide picture.
And more locally, you see a ton more seabirds in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands versus the main Hawaiian Islands. Now, is that just because there are no people living in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, or what would you attribute the population differences there?
Definitely the amount of people interfering with the birds, the amount of land predators, cats and rats and dogs affecting the birds are major players. But also there are differences in the geomorphology of the islands. Volcanic high islands harbor different types of seabirds from atolls, and we understand that. But I would say definitely, the fact that there's not a million people walking around the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, that really has left a lot of space for these birds to breed up there.
And so seabirds are a very important part of the whole marine ecosystem. What does this research that you do, how does that apply to some of the other species, or what picture does that paint for the whole marine ecosystem?
Yeah, I think particularly in tropical oceans, there's very interesting relationships between the seabirds, the tunas and other predatory fishes like mahi-mahi, wahoo, the aku, and the marine mammals. There's this, the bird piles, the interactions. If you do deep sea fishing, you are aware of some of these relationships. So I think studying the seabirds really opens up windows onto the ecological relationships and the possible threats affecting some of these other species, which may be also ingesting plastic by the same pathways that the seabirds are encountering the plastic.
And so if you could translate your research to managers, mm-hmm. what implications does your work have for the people who protect or try to conserve these areas?
Yeah, so I think we're still on a pretty early stage. So we are trying to come up with baselines, understanding what are the patterns at different locations, different species. Once we have done this and we can start building a picture of how does this plastic ingestion and pollution potentially affect the species, moving from the individuals that we find with material and extrapolating up to the species, then we'll be really able, hopefully, to add a sense of extra caution, extra precaution when we manage the species by considering additional effects, both direct and indirect, from the plastic. So again, we're still really early here at this stage, but we're trying to build a sense of additional impacts on these species via the ingestion of plastic and associated pollutants.
Well, and not, you don't want to be too humble, but I mean, you're not mm-hmm. just a researcher, you're very involved in education and conservation. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the education programs, like the Wing Ambassador project you're involved with?
Yeah, I think this is really the most rewarding aspect of my work, being able to work with teachers to create curriculum that uses the research to educate kids not only about the birds and the stewardship of the ocean, but also about science and, teaching them how tracking can be so valuable to understand movements and threats, and how math is integral in all these aspects. I think that's been really rewarding. And then on top of that, I think being able to work with artists, with photographers, with illustrators to merge art and science has also been very, very exciting and rewarding for me. I really love this part. I would love to make a puppet show. That's what I'm going to do when I retire, I will make an albatross puppet show. I'm going to buy a VW bus, and I'm going to drive around from Baja to Alaska, Southeast Alaska, and give a puppet show. That's my plan.
I think that's an excellent plan. Maybe you can even take the VW bus and transform it into it to look like an albatross.
Something like that would be cool. Ideal. Yes, definitely.
So you're going to need to be able to mimic those albatrosses for your puppet show. And so not to, you know, don't want to leave Sheila out alone in the corner there. We're going to have to listen to your albatross impersonation.
I'm actually going to do a shearwater because they've been biting my hands off lately, so I'm really fond of them. Let's see if I don't laugh. Something like that. And I'll share water with a cold.
Well, that's excellent. Thank you so much, David. You have some very, very cool research. And when we come back from a traffic break, we'll chat with both you and Sheila and also some of your grad students who have been working with you. I want to acknowledge some of our sponsors today, R&R Solar and Rolf Chris, Kona Red, the superfruit wellness beverage made with Hawaii's antioxidant-packed coffee fruits, Edible Hawaiian Islands, Inter-Island Solar Supply, and Kali Judd, Natural Energy Lab, Honolulu Weekly, and Sabrina's Restaurant.
KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
If you're coming into town from the west side, it's slow from Middle Street to the Punahou exit. If you're coming in from the east, you're good to Makiki now after some earlier problems on the H1 Evabound. No problems going to the windward side. Going east, there was a stall on the H1 eastbound at the 6th Avenue exit a few minutes ago. And if you're going west, the H1 slows at the Hickam curve. If you're taking the Moanalua, it slows as you get next to Moanalua Gardens.
Want to go green for your home or business? Hawaii Community Reinvestment Corporation introduces its new Green Sun Hawaii program, an innovative public-private partnership to make energy improvements affordable for everyone. Green Sun Hawaii gives you the power to significantly reduce your utility bill. Visit Hawaii National Bank or other participating lenders or one of the many authorized energy contractors for more information. Or visit greensunhawaii.com and click on the easy-to-use loan application.
Aloha. This is a solar daughter, Lena Davis. My dad, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, has been telling me to listen to him my whole life. It's helped me, and I'm sure it'll help you too. Be sure to listen to My Dad, the Solar Guy, 5 to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday on 760 KGU. Aloha!
Aloha! This is the solar guy, Jeff Davis. The solar industry has changed enormously in the last 3 years. So many companies have entered the market that one of the most asked questions I hear is, what makes your company different? Solar Services Hawaii has been serving Oahu and neighbor islands for more than 20 years. Solar Services was awarded the best inspection rate statewide from the Hot Water Rebate Program. We were number one. Solar Services is a local family company. We recognize the need for service with Aloha. I personally have given a class for the IRS. I've lectured many, including two luncheons with the National Association of Tax Preparers. Roof penetration and tax issues are my focus. For all solar products, meaning hot water, photovoltaic, pool and spa heating, solar pool pumps, solar attic fans, you name it. We specialize in photovoltaics and hot water, and of course a free estimate is available. Just call my phone, Jeff Davis the Solar Guy, at 554-7200. That's 554-7200. You have a great day and aloha.
This is Chief Louis Kealoha of the Honolulu Police Department. As part of the HPD's Safer Roads program, our officers are enforcing traffic laws 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. But we need your help. A few common sense choices can make a big difference. Stay within posted speed limits, use a hands-free cell phone device when driving, look out for pedestrians, and have a designated driver if you drink. Together, we can make Oahu's road safer and save lives. Aloha.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
Welcome back. bird is the word on this Friday evening. With us now, we have Dan Rapp and Sarah Youngren. Both are graduate students working on seabird biology with Dr. Heirenbach and have an impressive wealth of experience. You guys both just came back from the northwestern Hawaiian Islands not too long ago. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Just the beginning of August, we came back from Midway Island.
And so what were you guys doing out there? Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, this year, this was my second year on Tern Island. It was third for Sarah, but we were doing a plethora of things. One was our graduate work, where we were looking at plastic congestion and place on albatrosses, and Sarah was looking at other species, tritium storm petrels, and looking at plastics and doing acoustics work. Then we were also doing turtle monitoring. We were also doing fish and wildlife general monitoring for seabirds. And then we also had a grant-funded project, so it was very busy.
So you guys weren't slacking is basically what you were saying.
Yeah, it was not a lot of sleep and a lot of work, but it was very fun. So
when you say plastics, Sarah, is that similar to the methods that we were just discussing, or what exactly do you do with your plastic research?
Yeah, exactly what David was just talking about. Dan and I have been following the Procellariform seabirds, the two-nosed albatross and storm petrels, and looking at chicks as they grow and measuring their growth. And then if chicks die, which happens, sadly but true, we collect them and then necropsy them and see what kind of plastic loads they have in their stomachs.
So storm petrels and albatrosses are quite different. For those of us that don't know the difference between them, can you describe a little about how they differ?
Well, they're in the same general family, but they're very different in size. The storm petrels are the biggest, the tristrum storm petrel, which I was following, is about 100 grams. And the albatross are between 2,000 and 5,000 grams, which is a big difference. But they still have the general same feeding biology and breeding biology.
And were the albatrosses breeding when you were both out there?
Yes.
Yep.
So that's always a fun thing to watch.
Oh, yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah, this year we got to be there from when they hatched all the way to when they fledged, which is really amazing to see that.
And they're kind of fun, too. I mean, when they're chicks, they're covered in that soft fur, and as they start to lose it, they get these crazy haircuts, and they kind of remind me of, like, British modsters from the 1950s. They get these crazy looks to them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, the little hairdos that they all kind of develop, and they all kind of have their own little personalities, too. And
so, being students of marine science, what got you interested in your areas of study?
I'll go first. So after I did my undergraduate degree, I kind of started my life as a roving field biologist and worked out west in Wyoming, and eventually ended up having a position with Audubon, California, where I got a taste for bird work, more kind of forest birds. And then I got really interested in seabirds, and I really wanted to work with seabirds and specifically come out to the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. But since I didn't have a lot of experience, it was kind of difficult to get a position. But then I lucked out, and the previous manager for Tern Island gave me an opportunity to volunteer there and work with seabirds, and I got out there, and I knew, you know, not very long from having been out there that was it. You know, seabirds were what I wanted to do, and I fell in love with seabirds, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
And how about you, Sarah? You grew up in Alaska, didn't you?
Yeah, I grew up and went to school for my undergrad in Alaska, and while I was working on my undergrad, my advisor decided that I should become a seabird biologist and gave me a summer job working out on the Pribilof Islands, which are out in the middle of the Bering Sea, which have been referred to as the Galapagos of the North, but working with seabirds there. And ever since, I've been traveling around working on remote islands, working with seabirds.
So now that Alaska-Hawaii connection is kind of strong in the seabird world. Do you find a lot of similarities working out here in Hawaii compared to Alaska?
It's very similar. There's a lot of the same people working with people in Alaska, and then, oh, you've also worked on Tern. But then also, you know, you see the humpback whales in Alaska, and then you see them down in Hawaii, and I've kind of turned into a snowbird, you know, migrating with the birds. Their breeding seasons in Alaska are offset from them in Hawaii, so
just following that migratory pattern. And I mean, both of you being out at, were you out at Tern at the same time or at different times?
Yeah, we were out there at the same time the last two winters.
So for those of us that don't know, it's fairly remote. The Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, I mean, this is not luxury field work. What did you miss most about your normal day-to-day routine when you're out there?
To tell you the truth, we kind of like it out
there.
Yeah,
honestly, not. There's not much. Other than family being so far away. But other than that, yeah, there's not much.
It's a pretty special place. So when you come back to the main Hawaiian Islands, what do you miss most about Tern then?
Oh.
Maybe being able to walk to work and just having the birds and all the animals just so close. And, like, you go out the front door and you can sit and watch from the porch just all the amazing antics of the albatross and the sooty terns and the boobies and the frigate birds. So that's probably the hardest part, is not being able to see the birds as you walk out your front door.
So in all the research that you've done so far, what do you find to be the most fascinating, or what has surprised you the most?
Probably the plastics work, and just in general, try and do kind of find ways, I guess, to conserve the seabird populations. And I guess, yeah, the plastics work has been the most surprising, and just the crazy amount of just the sheer volume of plastic material that you find in not just Laysan albatross chicks, but other species, and just a plethora of different type of material, different types of plastics, and, you know, lighters, glow sticks, fishing material. And
have you started any collections as well from the plastic retrieval?
Yeah, we do have, not specifically from seabirds, but from Tern Island, we started a lighter collection. We have, for some reason, there's just gazoodles of lighters, disposable lighters that end up washing up, and so we have boxes and boxes of lighters, and again, like little figurines and toys and all sorts of weird stuff that washes up.
And what about you, Sarah? Is the plastics work also what's the most surprising to you?
Not really. I mean, it's very surprising and very depressing, but I think what's most surprising and maybe exciting and the happier end of things is the species that I've been working with, the Tristram storm petrel, which only nests in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands and similar latitude islands in Japan. And on Tern Island, before 1993, they didn't nest. And now they're nesting and their population is increasing. And so it's exciting to see a species that, you know, we don't know why, and we don't really have a good estimate of their population on other islands, but they're increasing on this island. So, you know, there's maybe some hope.
And can you describe what those nests are like for us?
So storm petrels in general nest in burrows and crevices. And on Tern, the Tristrams, which are a 100-gram bird, not very big, they can dig up to a meter-long burrow. And so they just go and in the sand and use their feet and dig a hole. And then they lay their egg in there and incubate it for their set period of time. And then their chick hatches, and then they leave it alone and just come back to feed it on a weekly, you know, depends upon the species, basis.
So that, I mean, they're very interesting animals. Do you ever get nervous that you're going to step on one of their burrows when you're out in the field walking around?
That's the worst part. You're walking around just constantly. Every step you take, that you're going to pick your foot back up. If you feel the ground move a little bit, and, oh no, I don't want to crush a burrow. I want them all to survive because they're special.
Tiptoe around. I remember being at Midway and literally, like, there's seabirds everywhere. Whether it's the petrels or the albatrosses, you can't go more than a foot without running into one, and just kind of tiptoeing or, you know, driving the golf carts around very carefully not to hurt anything. So where are you guys at with your research? Are you close to finishing, or what do you have? What's next for you guys?
Well, we're currently pursuing a graduate degree, and we've collected the bulk of our data already this past winter from Tern Island. And so, yeah, we have, you know, well over 100 Laysan chicks frozen that we will necropsy and look at plastic loads. And so, yeah, that's going to take a while and be a lot of work. And then we have other species, too. Like, we have lots of Tristram storm petrels that we brought back, and we have boluses that we brought back, and a few boobies and frigate birds that we brought back. So lots of necropsing in the future.
So it's nice. You're not just targeting one particular seabird. You're going
around. Part of my thesis is community-wide, so not just Laysan albatrosses, but looking at the other species that breed on the Tern Island, at the Tern Island Field Station.
And was your first, for those of us that don't know, what is a necropsy, and was your first necropsy really difficult for you?
Well, a necropsy is basically like a dissection. It's basically you open the bird up and you kind of look at the health of the bird, look what's going on inside the bird. And for us, we open the stomachs and see what's in the stomachs. And so, yeah, before I went out, my first experience at the Turner Island Field Station, I was trained on how to necropsy. And yes, it was very difficult at first, and you don't know, you know, how to open the bird up or where to cut, and you don't want to damage the tissues that you need to be able to look at to interpret if there's anything abnormal. But having done so many now, it goes a little faster and it's a little less stressful.
What about you, Sarah? Are you also necropsying animals?
Yeah, so I'm also looking at, my portion of our combined project is looking at the Tristram storm petrels and looking at their plastic loads. So I will necropsy those, and Dan and I are working together at attacking the pile of work to be done.
Well, it's important work, and I'm really excited to see where your research goes. So you'll have to let us know and come back and update us on
we can do that.
What's happening. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences. When we come back from the next traffic break, let's chat with all of you guys about the different types of birds that we're studying here in Hawaii. like to acknowledge the Focused Energy, Hawaii Legacy Hardwoods, Tom Moffitt Productions, Island Cooling, and UH Federal Credit Union. We'll be right back.
760 KGU,
part of the Wall Street Business Network.
No accidents or stalls right now. If you're headed to or passing through Wahiawa, expect slow traffic because of the bridge closure. From the North Shore, Kamehameha Highway slows before Dole Plantation. Wilikina Drive slows just after the split with Kalkonahua Road. From the south, the H2 slows at the end. Starting Monday, they're going to open one lane of the bridge, Haleiwa bound, during afternoon rush hour on weekdays.
Aloha, it's your solar guy, Jeff Davis, with a sure bet for you and your family. If you or someone you know believes they are living in a neighborhood that has no room on the grid to install more photovoltaics to erase your electricity bill, I can do it. I will guarantee to get your home approved by HECO, or I'll give you $100. Again, if you need PV on your home and you're under the impression that your neighborhood or your grid is full to saturation, I, Jeff Davis, the solar guy, can get your home installed and connected to HECO's net metering program, or I'll give you a $100 call-up bill. You just call me, the solar guy, Jeff Davis, at 554-7200, 554-7200. Aloha.
If you would like to contact Jeff either about the program or have any other questions about solar photovoltaics or hot water, call 554-7200. That's 554-7200.
If you would like to join Jeff Davis and his guests on the air, call now at 296-5467. That's 296-5467. Now back to the Solar Guy.
You're listening to Hawaii's Tomorrow with Jeff Davis, the Solar Guy.
So we've heard from across the board all kinds of research, from forest birds to albatrosses to different kinds of seabirds out in the northwestern and main Hawaiian islands. And a lot of it's been talking about plastics and bolus dissections, which is essentially bird throw-up. But you guys also have some really unique methods that you use for your research. David, you were just telling me about your GPS tracking of black-footed albatrosses. How does that work?
Yeah, this is really fascinating because we basically strap a little GPS like many people have in their car, you know, to find their way around town. Well, we put this with special tape on the back of the albatross. The albatross leaves the chick on the nest, flies from Kure all the way to the Emperor Seamount chain for 2 weeks, feeds, does all it does out there in the ocean, comes back, we retrieve the device, we plug it into the computer. After a few tries, it gives us the numbers, and we can recreate every 30 minutes where the bird was. We can recreate the way it oscillates in three axes, so we know whether it's flying or sitting on the water or what's going on. I mean, it is this awesome way to sort of spy into the secret lives of these birds, and it's really addictive.
Well, that sounds fascinating, especially there because they're so graceful out on the water, but not so great on land. Can you describe what they look like when they're landing and taking off? It's a pretty funny sight.
Yeah, I really like when the landing is not the most graceful, and they sort of straighten themselves up, and they always look around to see, did anybody see that? Or, no, okay, I'm fine. And then they'll walk very majestically with their sort of good stepping mode back to wherever they're heading. So, yeah, I think they're self-conscious about their not so graceful landings.
I can relate to the albatrosses. I'm pretty accident prone myself, and sometimes I feel like an albatross on land. But Sarah, too, you were talking about some other cool research. You use acoustics in your work. How does that come into play?
So the species I'm studying, the storm petrel, are nocturnal. And so most of the monitoring that you do is just kind of, you know, looking into their burrows and seeing if they're there during the day. But we get very little of their behavioral and just like the number of birds that are actually on the island. And so a common practice is to deploy a song recorder unit. And so we have, over the last winter, and they're being redeployed again on Tern Island, a set of wireless acoustic monitoring units. And so we're using cell phones in a fancy setup to record the nocturnal sounds of the island. And it's a really cool new adaptation to the general. Usually just put out a song meter and then leave it for a set period of time. But these units can actually satellite uplink. And so this is a project from the Coastal Action Management Lab in UC Santa Cruz.
Very cool. And don't think just you escaped making our bird noises for today, because it's important for our listeners to understand what these birds sound like. So we've already heard a couple choice species. Are you going to share with us your best petrel sound?
I will share the Tristram Storm Petrel. So they've been described as an inebriated elf, which I don't think is very nice, but they're very cute. So one call is a beep-a-doop-boop-boop-boop. And they just make a series of ridiculous squeaking noises, and they're the best.
Now, and that's all during the nighttime when they're active? Or?
Yeah, it's all during the nighttime. And we actually had trail cameras out this winter, and we have a video of one outside of a nest box calling to its mate. And you can see it calling and just bouncing around, making noises, and you can hear the mate calling from inside the box. It's pretty amazing.
That is a very cute sound, I have to say. You did that very well.
Thank you.
And Dan, do you have anything to add to that?
I will attempt to. The Laysan albatrosses have a lot of vocalizations, and one of them is that the parent will talk to the egg or talk to the chick that they're brooding. So I'll attempt that.
Sheila's nodding her head in approval, so if she gives you the thumbs up, then you know it was a good impression. That was fantastic. So aside from making funny bird noises here and talking about plastics and some of the more depressing aspects of this research, there's a lot of hope and there's a lot of interesting work that's being done here. Can you all share with me a little bit about what people can do or some hope in this research that we might be able to apply to future populations of seabirds or forest birds?
Well, I would like to encourage everybody who's listening in and everybody else to take a really strong interest in the health of Hawaii's watersheds, which is where we find most of our forest birds, which is where we get the water that we depend on for ourselves to drink, to irrigate our crops and so forth. And there's a really big move on in the Hawaii state government to promote protection of Hawaiian watersheds. And since we've been talking seabirds, I might add that there are some endangered, two species of endangered seabirds in Hawaii that breed in rainforests. So if you like seabirds, there's another good reason to protect Hawaii's watersheds and seabirds by learning about them and supporting the government programs that are attempting to protect them better than they're being protected right now.
And which are those endangered birds?
They are the wa'u, which sounds a little bit like that, and the a'o, which also sounds a little bit like that. But I think I've done enough bird imitations for today.
And David, what about you? What is your advice?
Well, I think this plastic issue may seem overwhelming, but, you know, we're all part of the problem and part of the solution, right? We're all consumers, and plastic is a wonderful thing, but we must be responsible consumers. And once we're trying to, for example, use less of the material, or if we have to use it, maybe dispose of it properly, make sure it doesn't end up in the on the watersheds or in the ocean. And, you know, be aware, information is power, and don't get depressed and do the little bit you can, and all together we can make a change.
Now, are there places on Oahu where people can go see seabirds?
Yes, there's many places where you can see seabirds. For example, I work at the Oceanic Institute, and during summer we have these huge clouds of sooty terns that breed out of Manana flying around. Really amazing. In the evenings you see the wedge-tailed shearwaters coming off Manana and making these big rafts and heading out to sea during summer and fall. This you can see from the beach right there. You can go to Kaena Point, this wonderful conservation effort to protect breeding seabirds, to remove the predators that are harming them on land, and you can see shearwaters and albatrosses. You can go to Black Point and see some of the shearwaters that are thriving amidst the bustle of Honolulu, a little incipient colony that's been growing and growing. They're really everywhere out there. And they're trying to make a living amidst us, you know. You can see furry terns flying around Honolulu. I mean, they're everywhere. You just have to be in tune and know what you're looking for.
Excellent. So they're available for us if we do want to explore mm-hmm. seabirds. And Sarah and Dan, what advice do you have for either students that are interested in seabirds or other type of advice you have from your research?
There's lots of opportunities out there. I mean, Dan and I both started working with seabirds. Well, I didn't start, but it had big opportunities working with seabirds on Tern Island, which is a fish and wildlife run field station and is mostly volunteer work. And so, you know, you don't have to apply for a job, and you can go out and, or you do have to apply for a job, but it's a little easier to acquire and a way to get lots of experience. So you can go on and, like we did, you know, go on to a master's program or go on to further study, and it's a foot in the door. So I recommend people, you know, if you're interested, look into these volunteer positions or, you know, entry-level jobs where you get to go out in the field and explore.
So would you say that this volunteering is very rewarding for you? Has it prepared you for a lot of the research that you're doing for your graduate studies work?
I think so. It's been just such a variety of things that I've learned while I was working on Tern Island, and just, yeah, it did prepare me for school.
Cool.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, there's, if you have an interest in seabirds or a passion or for anything else, you know, there are always opportunities. You just have to pursue them. And yeah, you can get out there and you know, interact with seabirds.
Spoken from the man who's wearing a plastic sucks t-shirt. I think that's very important. So you're not only researching, but you're practicing what you preach.
Yes, I think that is very important. If you're going to say something, you need to live by it.
And in seeing all this plastic in the boluses and the research that you guys do, have you made a conscious effort yourselves to try and reduce your plastic consumption?
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah, every time we go to the store and, you know, you see something that's in plastic or it's got a plastic wrapping, you know, you try to avoid those things because it's just, it's not going away. It's going to be around for a long time, you know, when you throw it in the trash. So, yeah, definitely, we try to live simply and keep our footprint, our ecological footprint low.
And if people want to find out more information about seabirds or, you know, how to reduce their plastic consumption, do you have any advice for where to go to get that information or any good sites that you guys use?
Yeah, I'd like to plug in the Algalita Marine Research Foundation has some really nice resources, both of the material that's out in the ocean and some ways to try to minimize the consumption. There's also, like you mentioned, the Winged Ambassadors for Ocean Stewardship Program, especially if there's any teachers out in the audience. I think you'll find these materials very useful.
Well, we have heard from Dr. Sheila Conant, Dr. David Heirenbach, and graduate students Sarah and Dan on the importance of environmental monitoring and fragile bird populations here in the Hawaiian archipelago. I'd like to acknowledge once again Hawaii's new COSI program, Island Earth. With 14 centers across the United States, Hawaii's new Island Earth COSI Center aims to connect marine science issues with both the visitor and local communities and places special emphasis on integration of Western and traditional knowledge. And so more information or to hear this podcast would be at www.cosi.net. I would like to thank all of my guests today who took time out of their busy schedules to speak with us, and a big shout out to Jeff Davis for inviting me to host today's program. I'd like to acknowledge some of our sponsors this evening: Lumen Solar LLC, Dior Horton Schuler Homes, Solar Services Hawaii, Blue Planet Foundation, Young Brothers, Green Sun Hawaii, offering credit enhancement loans guaranteed to make PV purchases more affordable. I'd like to end today's show with a quote from my favorite environmentalist and role model, Rachel Carson, who said, "The more clearly we can focus our attention on the wonders of the universe, the less taste we shall have for its destruction." I'm Carly Weiner. Thanks for listening. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.